at every step of the way, people have deep opinions of how you should be building out the business. And sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But ultimately, it boils down to you and to the team. And no one understands the business better than the people that live and breathe it every day, to take all of that feedback, build a framework around it, and decide what do you want to take and what do you not. If you try to execute on the feedback and the advice from everybody, you'll get nowhere.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Julian Alvarez. He's the co-founder and CEO at LogicsBoard. LogicsBoard recently raised a $13 million Series A led by Redpoint. Julian talks about how they were growing 30% month over month as they went out to raise that round. But it wasn't always smooth sailing. He faced dozens of rejections, had to move down to Colombia to be next to a customer for several months, and had a lot of doubters. He talks about how he learned to cut through the noise, how he sold his first customers, and how he navigated the Series A funding process. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Julian Alvarez. Hey, Julian. Hey. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited for this conversation because I've been following you for a while. We met back when you were in a WeWork. I think you just had a handful of people and you were grinding away in the very early days.
Yeah, it's been quite a long time. It was right before COVID. Yeah, it's been a while since we last met in person.
Yeah, congrats on all the progress, like Series A this spring and a lot of growth in the business. I'm very excited to get into the story. So I'm curious, man, you lived in Miami and then Colombia and you're from LA originally, I believe, yeah. And came to Seattle for Techstars. So like now Miami is all hot with startups. So are you going to move back there?
Miami is booming.
The company?
I have a lot of friends in Miami that have startups and seems to have really changed since we were there. But no, we are in Seattle for the long run. Honestly, I love it here. It's been great to us. So we're definitely going to stay here, but it's been great to see the progress that Miami has made over the last couple of years.
What was that decision like to move out here for Techstars, you know, literally diagonally across the whole country?
Yeah, I think it's the longest intercontinental flight in the US. So it was a huge change. At that point in time, we were actually living in South America in Colombia. Our first customer was based there and we spent about a year learning their operation. And we knew we had to come back to the US. We had to raise money. We had to start building a team. And I took a look at the US and basically told myself, let's apply it to startup accelerators. We got into Techstar Seattle with Chris DeVore and with Aviel. I flew over, met them, and I was convinced at once that Seattle was going to be the right place for us. So when we moved here for the program, the first day I started telling everybody that we were moving here full time. And I remember my co-founder, who's my brother, came up to me and he was like, Julian, everybody keeps telling me that we're moving to Seattle full time. What's going on? Long story short, we went back to Miami for 2 days, packed our bags and moved here. So it was not a difficult decision to make, honestly. I think a lot of people thought it was, but for us, it just made so much sense to move to Seattle and relocate the business here.
Love that. What was it about the community that drew you in or that made that so obvious?
I think there was a couple of things. So we operate in kind of the logistics world. I really liked the intersection of logistics with enterprise tech that Seattle had. You have the biggest logistics company in the world with Amazon, the biggest freight forwarder in the US with Expeditors, and some of the biggest enterprise SaaS companies out there. So I felt that combination was going to be really powerful for us. The second one, the level of talent that Seattle has, in my opinion, is unparalleled. So those two things I felt were going to give us a really big advantage as we built out the business.
So you go into Techstars and my understanding, and I think these were your words before we were recording, but you had a bunch of people as you're going through the mentor meetings, they're telling you that you're crazy because you're no technical co-founder, yep, and no domain expertise.
Yep.
Entering this crazy, complex, sort of unknown world of logistics and trucking and these companies. Tell me about those conversations and like how you decided to stay the course even after getting some of that feedback.
Sure. They were really fascinating. One of the things that I appreciated about Seattle is we were actually sitting down with people that understood SaaS. That was difficult for us to find in Miami. And the first couple of weeks, we probably met with 40 people, pitched our story, pitched our idea, and everybody came back and told us to pivot, honestly. Everybody had a lot of different ideas as to what we should do. Juan and I basically went back to the drawing board. We built a massive matrix of all the ideas that people were floating by us and included the one that we originally had. And what it really boiled down to, we had done so much product discovery and so much customer discovery before we got to the program. We fundamentally felt that we had the right approach. So we took all of the feedback. I think we did a really good job at taking what we thought was going to work and blocking out the noise. Part of being a founder, everybody's going to give you a lot of advice and you take what you can and what you think applies and the rest, you block it out. But we took a probably unconventional approach for most people. We doubled down on what we were doing. I think it was, driven by deep conviction that we were entering a massive market that had to digitize and that if we could build a SaaS application, we can fuel the entire ecosystem there. But it was one of the defining moments for us as a company, for sure.
What gave you that conviction? What was it coming from the customer discovery or what was it about your, you know, way of getting that to that made you say, okay, of all these possible paths we can go down now, that we feel like this is the one to bet our lives on?
You know, I think it tracks back to probably 18 months earlier. Juan and I started the company together and we did not have domain expertise. Juan had worked at a freight forwarder for probably 8 months and understood the pain and the gap really early, but it was something that we did not understand. We also had never worked at a SaaS company. We didn't know how to code. We didn't know much about technology. And the way we started the business, we literally went around Miami. Miami has a lot of freight forwarding companies and just started knocking on doors. And we would go into people's offices and say, hey, we have an idea. We'd like to run by you. We kept iterating and iterating. We probably got rejected the first 50 times that we went to customers pitching our idea. And that kind of changed. We then started building out mockups on Envision and showing to customers what we wanted to build. And again, just constant reject. We continued to iterate and that process was really helpful for us to actually understand what the market needed. It was a little bit of a leap of faith, to be honest. I think at that point when we started the business, a lot of people in the industry did not think the industry would digitize and it would shift. And we fundamentally felt like every industry is going to digitize. Freight forwarding is just behind other industries. So we took a leap of faith, had conviction that the market would shift, that we could support it. But it was that process of doing deep customer discovery, not having a technical co-founder. A lot of people will tell you that you should never start a SaaS company without a technical co-founder, but it's actually really helpful for us. It forced us to get really uncomfortable. It helped force us to really uncover the pain of the customer. And that validation was ultimately what gave us conviction that we were taking the right approach and that we had to double down on our idea and kind of hypothesis in the market.
What do you think would have happened if you had a tech co-founder? Like how would it have played out differently where maybe you wouldn't have been gone as deep with the customers or what would have been the consequence of that?
I think there would have been a lot of pressure to start building quickly. And frankly, I look back and say, wow, the first 2 years, we should have moved a lot faster. But I also think if we would have moved a lot faster, we would have not landed on the right idea. So having a technical co-founder, I think we would have ultimately taken a different path on what we built. And I think it would have been a mistake. We would have ultimately had to change our approach deeper down the line. It would have been really expensive to make that change. There is a really good story there that we'll talk about. After we raised our seed round, we actually had to rebuild our product from scratch. So we felt a little bit of that pain there. But not having that technical expertise, I think actually allowed us to uncover the deepest pains in the market and be really obsessed with what products could we deliver that can maximize ROI for our customers.
So you did have to pay some price for this later, it sounds like, down the road, right? So there was some benefit in that forcing that constraint that it forced in customer discovery and having to basically get conviction around your idea before you could go build something. But then you had to ultimately pay the price for it somewhere down the road.
Yeah, definitely. We paid the price further down the road where we had to rebuild a product. It wasn't a pivot, but we definitely had to do a rebuild. We tested our initial hypothesis with not a lot of funding. And once we actually received the funding and showed that there was demand in the market for what we wanted to do and what we were building, we took a step back and rebuilt our product. But we did pay the price, but ultimately that's part of startups. You make mistakes, you learn from them, you iterate, but things seem to be working well for us so far.
I love it. Okay, you go and you're talking to these customers, you move in with one in Colombia, basically. You got to tell me a little bit about how that happened. Like,
Yeah, it's
you said deep customer discovery, and you also said moving to Colombia to be close to one of your customers. So can you connect that thread for us?
Yeah, we actually sold our first customer off of PowerPoint. They came in and agreed to be our beta customer. And what we did, Juan and I actually relocated to Colombia full time. We were there for a year. Juan was there basically the entire year. I was there for about half of it. But we moved into this company, their entire operation. We started learning the business. It was really in our sweet spot. It was a mid-market freight forwarding company, one of the largest freight forwarders in Colombia. And it really helped us understand the pain points. We started going in and talking to everybody in the operation, worked out of their offices. It gave us a huge advantage, not just in what we wanted to build and understanding the pain points, but deep advantage in having customer empathy. When you don't come from the industry and you don't have domain expertise and you can actually ingrain yourself into an operation and develop that muscle for empathy, that was critical for us.
What was one of the most surprising things that you saw or learned during that period of getting literally just inside of their business?
No, I think a lot of people have the belief that freight forwarding companies don't leverage technology, and they do. So I was pleasantly surprised by that. I actually was really surprised that they did embrace technology and they were a lot more advanced than I expected them to be. That was one. At the same time, I thought there was a really deep opportunity there to help freight forwarders level up and think more like startups, where things move really quickly, where you're selling in a much more modern way. I think there was a really big gap there. It still felt quite antiquated in the way that people were selling and approaching business development and sales, where it was going door to door, wining and dining. And we felt that we could really embed technology to facilitate and to help with that process.
How many swings of the bat, so to speak, did it take before you got that customer who bought your PowerPoint deck? What was the process like behind that? Because you didn't just magically one day manifest this one magical customer who's like, yeah, we'll give you money, come over here, learn from us, build around our use case. Yeah. What did it take to get there?
Yeah, definitely. So I'd say it took about 50 rejections from other freight forwarders first. That was one of them. The second piece, it probably took 7 months and 6 flights down to Colombia trying to convince this operation that the approach that we wanted to take was the right one. And honestly, to build trust with them, to buy into our journey and into our process. But a lot of rejection, a lot of iteration, and a lot of conviction that what we wanted to do was the right thing. As I mentioned earlier, it really took a leap of faith from them and from us going into a market, again, where you don't have domain expertise, where people are telling you that the market is not going to shift and not going to digitize, and placing the bet that it actually is. It was a little bit of founder, I think, one of them. And just having a conviction that all markets digitize and that we could help level these companies up in terms of technology.
It's incredible that you had this optimism in the face of all the doubt from the investors, as well as just on rejection 48 and 49, you kept going, right?
It was both, right? We had probably 50 rejections from customers and finally ended up landing on the right approach. And we ended up making the right bet, which was the market was going to change. And a couple of years later, that why now of the business was really strong and further amplified by COVID, frankly. And the second one, at the same time, we were getting rejected back and forth by investors as well. I think the first, before we raised our seed round, the first 60 people that we went out there and pitched our story to, they all rejected us as well. So it was rejection coming from the market, rejection coming from investors as well. But I embraced that. Frankly, it's part of what fuels me and what fuels the company. I think it's understanding that there is deep pain in the market, focusing on the customer and placing bets on where you think the market is going to go. But it's not easy. Embracing that rejection, I think I've had to have it deeply embedded in my DNA. I think it helps that both my parents were entrepreneurs. I saw that journey as I was growing up and at the kitchen table. But it needs to be embedded into every entrepreneur's DNA. Otherwise, the journey is just too difficult. managed.
There's this framework, and I'll probably source it wrong. You have to be contrarian on one axis and or non-consensus, I think is the way they say it, non-consensus and right. And you're getting all this signal that you're non-consensus, right? Through all the rejections and the no's and the oh, you should pivot. And then like at some point you figure out that you were right. Was there a turning point, or was it a little bit more of like a slow warming process where it, like the data started to tip the other direction? Because obviously then you went on and you raised the Series A and COVID put a tailwind behind your business. And how did that turn to the point where now you could raise institutional money and start to amass customers and grow the business?
It's a really good question. I'd say that there's a couple. When we went through Techstars, we really focused on business development, and we were able to validate that the entire market had a deep desire for the product that we were building. It was really driven by SMBs, mid-market customers, and enterprise as well. So most of the folks that we were talking to at that point were starting to come around to the idea that the market would digitize. The second aspect there, once we raised our seed round right after the program, we actually had to go through an entire product rebuild. So I remember showing up to our first board meeting. You know, we just raised $6 million and telling our investors, we have to go rebuild the product that you just bet on. They were incredibly supportive. I'm, you know, forever grateful of them saying, we believe in you, we believe in the team, and let's get after it. When we started that product rebuild at the end of 2019, we basically had to go back to the drawing board. So I started talking to customers all over again. I'd say our first maybe 5 to 10 customers all signed with us off PowerPoint. We were selling the vision of what we were building, and they actually said, we'll sign up. If you deliver this, we'll be paying customers. That for us was a huge tipping point in the market. It's a market that's really underserved by technology providers. The technology providers that the market has worked with, they've been burned over and over again. So when we started seeing companies that were SMB and mid-market signing contracts with us ahead of the product being delivered, we really knew that we had something special. And that we can build a really big business.
So I want to be careful not to interpret your story as just, you know, have conviction and plow forward no matter what's happening. Because underneath all that, while you're getting all this doubt and all the rejections from customers and investors, you're also getting a lot of building signal that you're getting, staying close to your customer. And so that sort of, it sounds like that kind of reached a crescendo when you asked them for money.
It did. I think there was a lot of critical things there. When we first started the business, I think we had conviction that the why now for building the business and for building our product was going to be really powerful a couple of years in. So it's almost taking a bet on a market. And when we actually started going out and saying, hey, we're going to commercialize this product and build it, that why now had deeply accelerated. So we were able to do deep discovery upfront. And by the time we were actually getting out there, the market had shifted. I think that prediction turned out to be the correct one. But second, yeah, to your point, once we actually started telling people we're taking this out to market and people started saying, we will pay for this, that was a huge turning point for us as well. So I'd say both things. It definitely wasn't have deep conviction and plow through it no matter what. It really, at its core, it came down to that deep product discovery that we continue to do today. We are, you know, keenly focused on understanding our customers, their pain points, and building solutions that can drive value for them. It would have never happened without our customers, without those early customers taking a bet on us and guiding us through their most critical aspects of the business and how we could empower it. So there was a lot of things that had to align there, to be honest, and a lot of failures and a lot of mistakes along the way as well.
I love this. You mentioned the why now. I love that framework of, you know, what's your why now? Why this? Why now? Just so listeners have an example, what is your why now in a short form? And I think the follow-up is, how did that time frame or that answer get accelerated in the pandemic?
Yeah, it's really two things. One, we have an entire hypothesis. There are new entrants going into the freight forwarding market with a digital-first approach. Companies like Flexport, Beacon, Nowports, et cetera, basically raising a lot of venture financing to go build a new modern freight forwarder. But at their core, they are logistics companies with great technology. And the hypothesis that we had was these companies are going to grow to own 1 or 2% of the market. the rest of the market is going to have to level up in terms of technology to remain competitive. Why don't we build SaaS to level the rest of the 99% of the market up? Mm. So the why now of digital freight forwarding companies raising massive amounts of venture has added pressure to them, coupled with enterprise level freight forwarding companies also investing millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to build better tech. So in that sense, that why now, when you see new entrants and the really big players making changes, the rest of the market has to adapt, and we help them make that transformation really quickly. The second aspect here with COVID, people could no longer go into their customers' operations, wine and dine them. It really forced them to digitize the way that they were engaging with their customers. And when we think about digitalization, it's a really loaded word, right? There's internal processes. It's a word that everybody likes to use today. But we really think about digitalization at its core is how do you digitize that end user experience? B2C companies have done a phenomenal job there. B2B companies, it's not been their traditional focus, especially when you look at a legacy industry like freight forwarding. So we really doubled down on the approach of how do we help an old school B2B industry digitize that end user experience. For us, digitalization starts with that. And COVID really accelerated that process for freight forwarding companies across the globe and logistics providers across the globe.
I like your, yeah, your why now. It's nice because you have the market trigger of this existential threat to your customer. And then you have persona or ICP specific lens of the small and mid players who are, you know, feeling this pain in the most acute way. And then you got this other just tailwind with COVID. So I can see how all those pieces lined up really well.
Yeah, it lined up really well. And part of, again, what we've really been focused on is that ROI, like selling SaaS to companies for the sake of selling it. You can either be generating deep efficiency, helping companies make more money, or neither, in which case companies are really likely to churn, right? What we've seen when companies adapt our product, we actually help them increase the revenue dramatically. Our customers use our product to go out and win new business. And sometimes they're winning business against Flexport as well and some of the other digital freight forwarding companies. And seeing that come full circle, that the hypothesis that we had that if we could empower traditional players or existing players, they would remain competitive or even beat out the new entrants to the market. We see that consistently. It's part of what we talk about as a team every day. Our customers telling us that they won really large accounts leveraging our application as a value add to their customers. So it's pretty phenomenal. It wasn't just the why now, but for us, the most important thing is why now and how do we provide deep value to our customer base?
So people who are listening to this can't see when you smile, but when you were talking about making mistakes, you had a big smile on your face. And you told me before that you think a lot about the gift or the gifts that come from mistakes. So I wanted to dig into that a little bit more and just hear how you talk about that inside the company. Hear how that principle gets shared inside Logix Board and how you guys act on it.
Yeah. It's one of the things that I grew up on, frankly. It was something that we talked about again with our folks at the dinner table consistently. We saw them make so many mistakes when we were growing up and embrace them. It was something that was embedded in our DNA. But at Logix Board, we have a deep bias for action. And when you have a deep bias for action and for speed, undoubtedly, you'll make mistakes, which we do, honestly, probably every day. And a big part of this is talking to the team and saying, it's okay to make mistakes. There's very few mistakes that will actually cripple a business. I think embracing that and understanding that makes companies less reactive and much more proactive. But when we do make mistakes, and when we make mistakes in how we communicate with our customers, how we provide visibility, how we, ran an implementation, we own it. And we own it as a company. It's never a mistake at an individual level. If there are mistakes that we made them together. A lot of that disagree and commit mentality, and we win and lose as a team, goes behind that process of making mistakes. Something that I don't know if I want to say deeply encourage making mistakes, but deeply encourage for us to embrace them and to learn from them. I think mistakes are some of the biggest gifts that life gives us. And if we're able to use those to really learn and to get better, not just as a company, but as humans, it's a process that I embrace.
So tell me about a mistake that you've made and then how you go through and actually extract the GIFs. To me, that's really the interesting part. Is I make a ton of mistakes, but I'm trying to figure out if I have a good framework for how to then take that and take what you're calling the gift out of it and really get the most from it.
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know what? I think in some ways, because we are so customer focused and we have so much empathy, we tend to really rely on our customers to guide our product roadmap and guide on what we want to be building. I think at sometimes we've taken on way too big of a surface area for us to, you know, actually deliver successfully, which puts us in binds. Sometimes we've covered too much, not delivered successfully, and it requires really going back to our customers and explaining that to them. I think having deep transparency, when we have made mistakes, we always want to communicate that with customers and make sure that they understand why the mistake was made. I think some of those mistakes of building too much at once and not focusing super keenly on solving one problem, something that we made early on in our journey as a company, and we've completely flipped that around. Now we always think about how do we stay really focused on what we're building to solve specific pain points, as opposed to trying to do too much at once. Because if you try to do too much at once, you ultimately stumble and fail. But they were mistakes that we had early on in our journey. We embraced them. We learned from them. And we were able to adapt. And now we deliver at a much better pace with much more focus and much more understanding of what we actually want to build and deliver to our customers.
What's the next big mistake you think you're going to make?
What's the next big mistake that I think we're going to make? I think there's a really big change in going from a company that is a seed stage company to a Series A company. I think it requires everybody to level up, including myself and the entire leadership team. A lot of what we've been really focused on is how do we actually, all of us, start leveling up and no longer going really deep down into the weeds to solve all of the problems. And when you start raising additional rounds of financing, you actually have to bring in the right people that can own those specific verticals and solve the problem for you. So I think if I did not have the advisors that I have and relied on people to really help us through our journey and be humble about it when we ask for advice, that would have been a mistake that we would have made. I think trying to still stay in there, do everything, I think ultimately what that causes is it doesn't give you the framework to scale as a company. So I think that would have been our biggest mistake, but it's something that we've really honed in on. And now we're just really focused on trying to build the right infrastructure and to bring in the right people that can help scale the business.
I'd love to just spend a couple minutes on the process of raising the Series A. Yeah, what was it like going out there to raise your first time, raising institutional money, going to traditional VC pitches, Monday partner meetings, all the stuff? Like, I guess the question I'm curious about is like, what surprised you most about going out and doing that?
Yeah. Our seed round and our Series A were fundamentally different, honestly. And I think during our seed round, I learned how you should raise. And on our Series A, I took the learnings from our seed round and executed much better. I also just embraced the rejection and I realized that there's a framework to raising financing and it's a process. Whereas I didn't really understand that when I was first starting out with the company. So what really surprised me, when you do deep prep work for raising a round of financing and really take the time to build the right formula for how you want to raise ahead of actually starting to raise, things go a lot smoother. So our Series A took under a month to raise. It was a really fast process. We oversubscribed, competitive. I think it was part of that journey of understanding that there's a formula to raising financing, or at least there's a formula for me. Entrepreneur, I'm sure, has a different journey with raising money, but that there was a formula to it and that if we followed it, we were going to be successful. That was a huge part of the learning. And the second piece, by the time we went out to raise our A, I had a lot of advisors that could guide us through that process. It's one of the things that I constantly think about. How do I surround myself with people that can really help level up, not just the company, but myself? By the time we were doing our Series A, I had really found some people that could really help me. through that journey.
Got it. Yeah. So you were like, I don't need to reinvent how to fundraise. A lot of people have done this. I'm going to figure out what the formula is and try to execute on that to some extent.
I think everybody has to build their own formula. I think you have to understand what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are. I think as a founder, you also have to determine, is raising capital something that you enjoy? Is it not? And a lot of block out the noise. Everybody tells you different things of how you should be raising funding, who you should be talking to, and carving out your own journey and understanding what works for you and what doesn't. That was something that I learned in our seed round and applied it for a Series A.
Sounds like you've had a lot of practice blocking out the noise, Julian.
I have. It's one of the things that really helps guide me. Again, when you're building a company, at every step of the way, people have deep opinions of how you should be building out the business. And sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But ultimately, it boils down to you and to the team. And no one understands the business better than the people that live and breathe it every day to take all of that feedback, build a framework around it, and decide what do you want to take and what do you not. If you try to execute on the feedback and the advice from everybody, you'll get nowhere. I think I learned that really quickly.
So you had this competitive round, you raised $13 million, great top tier investors. Not so much curious about what you nailed with the pitch and the packaging, but what within the business was it that you had most right in the eyes of investors that led to what I think most people who are in the seed stage would say, that's the kind of Series A I want.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Coming into the round, we were growing above 30% month over month. I think the growth and the acceleration really proved that there was really strong demand in the market for what we were building. We had really healthy metrics around some of the sales aspects that the venture community typically looks for. And it was a massive market. I think we really were able to explain to people why the why now was so critical. I think that aspect was really helpful as well. So it was a little bit of a really strong why now coupled with a massive market. We showed that we had the ability to really execute quickly, especially coming out of that product rebuild and the acceleration on the growth and the revenue side. I think really helped put the framework in place for us being able to raise a round of financing. We actually went out to raise a round of financing earlier than we anticipated. And it was really led by that. We had massive demand from the market that we sell to for the product that we were building. We knew that we had to go build a lot more integrations. We had to continue to enhance and to mature our product. And we really looked at it as we are capital constrained. We need additional financing to go build and really capture the market. And I think when you find yourself in that position as a founder where your business is accelerating and the constraint for you is capital, I typically tend to think that's when you should be raising, not ahead of that.
Love it. Congrats on all the progress. I think this is a perfect time to wrap it up with the Supersonic Six.
Cool. Awesome. I'm excited.
That's your rapid fire round. Okay. Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
Oh, I am Colombian, and Colombians are notoriously known to drink a lot of coffee. I'd say probably about 4 cups a day.
Is that low by Colombian standards?
I think it's low. It's a Colombian in Seattle, if that helps.
Yeah. You might even be a little higher than the Seattle average. I don't know. I'll know after we get to a couple hundred podcasts what the average is. Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I really like what my friend Serbi is doing at Symbol.ai. I think what they're doing around conversational intelligence, it's fascinating. Serbi is a founder that I know really well. And I think the traction and the momentum that she has on her business and the value that they're delivering to their customers is phenomenal. So that's a company that I always keep a close eye on.
Number three, who's one other Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
John Gelsey. John was the CEO of OddZero, CEO of Exnor, which got acquired by Apple. But John is someone that I learned from deeply and that has really helped not just me level up personally and the company level up, but he's someone that I really respect and admire and go to for a lot of feedback and for a lot of advice.
Number four, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
It's a challenging question for me to answer. I think Seattle is a phenomenal environment for startups. I think capital is readily accessible. think the talent is phenomenal. If anything, I just want Seattle to start opening back up so that I can start seeing people again and actually meeting a lot more founders and a lot more people that are interested in startups. I think it's difficult to do that virtually. So that's one thing that I want to happen again, just meetups for the startup community.
All right. Bring back the in-person. Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Embrace the rejection and block out the noise. It's something that I talked about a lot today, but it took me 10 years to really figure that out. If I had known that a little bit earlier, I think it would have helped me accelerate things faster, but it's something that I deeply believe in now. And it wasn't something that I've had as mature when I was 20 than now.
Number six, what can this community do to help you? Do you have any job posts you want people to look at, events? What call to action do you have for folks?
We are hiring across the board for all functions in the business, engineering, product design, go to market. We have a lot of those job postings in our website, but ultimately, I think companies are built by people, and we're always looking to partner up with the right folks for our journey. Companies growing really quickly in a massive market, but for us, I think just identifying and meeting people that we can partner up with to build LogicSport would be priority number one.
Awesome. I just looked. It's LogicSport, LogicSport.com/careers for people who are interested.
Correct.
Open positions in, looks like just about every function. Plenty of opportunities for people there. Julian, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Adam. It was great, and thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.